It is long, long since, but we can all remember how, once as a lad, alone and dispirited, at odds with his brothers, he had looked down from the hill by Kirjath Arba upon the moon-white town in the valley, and upon Machpelah, the twofold hollow, the rock tomb which Abram had bought and where the bones of his ancestors rested. We recall the strange medley of feelings in his soul, aroused by sight of the tomb and of the populous town lying there asleep, feelings of piety, which is reverence for death and the past, mingled with a half-mocking, half-fascinated drawing to the city and the busy human life which all day long filled the crooked streets of Hebron with clamor and reek, and at that hour lay snoring in its chambers with its knees drawn up. It may seem bold and arbitrary to connect such feelings, which, after all, were so early and so momentary, with the considered conduct of his present age, and probably still more rash to make the latter depend on the former. Yet there is some evidence in favor of the association. I mean the remark which Joseph later made to the old man, his purchaser, when they were together in Menphe, the metropolis. He had idly said that he liked the place, whose dead had not to ferry over the water, because they were already west of the river, and remarked that among the cities of Egypt this one pleased him most. That was entirely characteristic of Rachel's eldest, far more than he realized himself. He had taken great pleasure in the way the little people of Menphe, in a mocking spirit preserved in the midst of their monotony, had blithely shortened the ancient grave name of the city Men-Nephru-Mire to Menphe. And this pleasure was almost Joseph himself. It revealed the deepest depth of his nature. We call that feeling of his by the name of sympathy, a rather tame word for so profound an emotion as it actually is, for sympathy is a meeting of life and death. True sympathy exists only where the feeling for the one balances the feeling for the other. Feeling for death by itself makes for rigidity and gloom. Feeling for life by itself, for flat mediocrity and dull-wittedness. Wit and sympathy can arise only where veneration for death is moderated, has, so to speak, the chill taken off, by friendliness to life, while life, on the other hand, acquires depth and poignancy. This happened in Joseph's case, and his shrewd and friendly temper was the result. This was the blessing, the double blessing with which he was blessed from the heights above and the depths which lay beneath, the blessing which Jacob his father launched into on his deathbed, behaving as though he then gave and conferred it, whereas, after all, he was only reasserting an already accomplished fact. Any attempt to examine the moral foundations of our exceedingly complicated world requires a certain amount of learning. Of Jacob, it had always been said that he was Tam, meaning that he was upright and that he dwelt in tents. But Tam is an equivocal word, not properly rendered by upright. It is both positive and negative. It is yes and no, light and darkness, life and death. It turns up again in the curious formula Urim and Thummim, where, in contrast to the light affirmative Urim, it obviously stands for the dark, death-shadowed aspect of the world. Tam, or Thummim, is the light and dark, the upper and the underworld at once and by turns, and Urim only the light, as distinguished in pure usage. So Urim and Thummim does not actually express a contradiction. It only exhibits the mysterious truth that when one separates a part from the whole of the moral world, the whole always stands opposed to the part. It is not so easy to make head or tail of the moral world, first of all, because what is sunshiny in it refers to the underworldly. Esau, for instance, the red one, was distinctly a sun-man of the lower world, and Jacob, his younger twin, set off against Esau as a mild moon-shepherd, did, we must remember, spend the better part of his life in the underworld with Laban, and the means he used there to become gold and silver are very inaccurately described by the word upright. Urim he was certainly not, but Tom precisely describes him, a glad, sorry man, like Gilgamesh. And Joseph was that too, whose rapid adaptation to the sunny underworld of Egypt as little indicates a Urim nature pure and simple. Urim and Thummim might be rendered as yes, yes, no. That is, yes, no, with the coefficient of a second yes. Mathematically speaking, after the yes and the no have cancelled each other out, only the second yes is left. But the purely mathematical has no coloration at all, or at least it ignores the dark tone of the resultant yes, which is obviously an after-effect of the eliminated no. All that is, as I said, involved. We do better merely to repeat that in Joseph life and death met. And the result was that sympathy which was the profounder reason why he asked Pharaoh's permission to live in Menphe, that sprightly metropolis of tombs. The king had first of all taken thought for the eternal dwelling of his universal friend, and it was already under way. He now gave Joseph a residence in the dearest quarter of Menphe, a sunny dwelling-house with garden, reception hall, fountain court, and all the amenities of that late, early time, not to mention a host of Nubian and Egyptian servants for kitchen, vestibule, stable, and hall, who swept and garnished and sprinkled the villa and adorned it with flowers, under the supervision of guess whom. But, of course, even the slowest in the uptake must have known long ago, for Joseph kept his word more punctually and punctiliously than Nefer Emwesi, the cupbearer, had kept his. He straightway honored the promise he had made to somebody when they parted, that he would send after him and take him to himself whenever he should be lifted up. While he was still in Thebes, immediately after he got back from his tour of inspection, with Pharaoh's approval, he wrote to Maisakhme, the warden at Zawi Re, and invited him to be his house steward and head of his house and of all those matters which such a man as Joseph now was could not take on himself. Yes, he who had once been overseer in Petipre's house, and to whom a so much greater charge had now fallen, he himself had an overseer over everything that was his, wagons and horses, storerooms, house servants, scribes and slaves, and that was Maisakhme, the imperturbable, who was not startled when the letter of his former convict reached him, if only because it was not given him to be startled. Nevertheless, he did not even wait for his successor to arrive at the prison, but betook himself by leaps and bounds to Menphe, a somewhat out-of-date city, of course, quite overcrowded by Thebes in Upper Egypt, but in comparison with Zawi Re, immensely stimulating. Imhotep, the wise, the many-sided, had lived and worked there, and now Imhotep's great admirer had been beckoned hither to a splendid post. Maisakhme put himself at once at the head of Joseph's house, assembled the staff, bought, furnished, and bestowed, so that when Joseph came down from Wese, and Maisakhme met him at his own beautiful gateway, he found his house equipped in every detail as the residence of a great man. He even found an infirmary ready for such as would wreathe and wind, and a pharmacy where his overseer might mix and titurate to his heart's content. The meeting was most cordial, though of course the two could not embrace in view of the surrounding staff. The embrace had taken place once for all when they parted, in the only moment proper to it, when Joseph was no longer Maisakhme's servant, but not yet Maisakhme's lord. The steward said, "Welcome, Adon. Lo, here is your house. Pharaoh gave it, and he whom you command, commanded it, down to the smallest detail. You need only go to the bath, be anointed, sit down, and eat. But I thank you very much for thinking of me and pulling me out of my tedium directly you sat in glory. And now everything has come out as your servant always imagined it would, and you have called me to share your varied and diverting life, which I shall strive to deserve." Joseph replied, And in my turn I thank you, you good soul, for answering my call, and being willing to be my housekeeper in this new life. It came as it has come, because I never offended my father's God by the smallest doubt that he would be with me. But do not call yourself my servant, for we shall be friends as we were before, when I was beneath your feet, and together shall we meet the good and bad hours of life, the exciting and the unexciting. There will certainly be both, and I need you most for the exciting ones. For your careful oversight, I thank you in advance. But it must not consume you to the extent that you have no leisure to guide the reed in your study, as you love to do, to find the right and fitting form for the story of the three love affairs. Great is the writer's art, but truly I find it greater yet to live in a story. This that we are in is certainly a capital one. Of that I am more and more convinced the longer I live. And now you are in it with me, because I brought you. And when in the future people hear or read of the steward who was with me and at my side in exciting moments, they will know that this steward was you, my Sakme, the man of poise. The Maiden. Once, in the beginning, God made a deep sleep to fall upon the man he had set in the garden in the east. And while the man slept, God took out one of his ribs and closed the place up with flesh. But out of the rib he made a woman, in the opinion that it was not good for man to be alone, and presented her to the man that she should be about him for company and help. And it was very well meant. Our teachers have painted this presentation in very fine colors. Thus and so, they say, it happened. They behave as though they knew all about it, and it may be they really do know. God washed the woman, they assure us. He washed her clean, for naturally she was a bit sticky, anointed her, rouged her face, curled her hair, and at her urgent plea, adorned her head, neck, and arms with beads and precious stones, among them sardonyx, topaz, diamond, jasper, turquoise, amethyst, emerald, and onyx. He brought her thus embellished before Adam, with a choir of thousands of angels singing and playing on their lutes to present her to the man. Then there was a feast and a feasting, that is to say, a festal meal, of which it seems God himself most affably partook, and the stars danced together to the music they themselves made. That was the first great wedding feast. But we do not hear that it was also straightway a marriage. God made the woman for a helper to Adam, simply in order that she might be about him, and had obviously thought no more about it. That she should bear children in suffering, he only inflicted upon her after she and Adam had eaten of the tree and their eyes had been opened. Between the feast of the presentation and the time when Adam knew his wife, and she bore him the farmer and the shepherd, in whose footsteps Jacob and Esau walked, between these comes the story of the tree and the fruit and the serpent and the knowledge of good and evil. For Joseph, too, it came in this order. He, too, knew the woman only after he had learned what good and evil are of a serpent who would have given her life to teach him what is very, very good, but yet evil. But he resisted her and had the art to wait until it was good and no longer evil.